Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group Podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Practice Groups, was recorded on Thursday, December 5th, 2019, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Federal Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon's topic is titled The Trump Impeachment Effort and is a part of an ongoing conversation series with John Malcolm and John Yoo. My name is Wesley Hodges, and I'm the Associate Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are very fortunate to have with us Professor John C. Yoo, who is the Emanuel S. Heller Professor of Law at the University of California at Berkeley School of Law. As well with us is Mr. John G. Malcolm, who is Vice President at the Institute for Constitutional Government, Director of the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, and Senior Legal Fellow for the Heritage Foundation. After our speakers give their remarks, we will have time for your questions, so please keep in mind questions you have throughout this call, and we'll be ready for you towards the end. Thank you very much for sharing with us today. Professor Yoo, I believe the floor is yours to begin.
Thank you, Wesley. Thanks to the Federal Society for having us back in this series on a series on the Mueller Report, and look where we are now. Back to the Mueller Report. And thanks to John Malcolm joining the John and John Show, as we're starting to call it. Let's just start. We scheduled this a little while ago, but we had perfect timing as always, because just this morning, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, ordered the articles of impeachment to be drafted up by the House Judiciary Committee. And we've just finished last week and a half ago the testimony in the House Intelligence Committee on the facts of the impeachment inquiry. And yesterday, I guess, was the first day of hearings by law professors and legal scholars about the constitutional standards governing impeachment. And we're going to have more for the rest of the week. So we couldn't have had better timing. I thought what we'd do in the presentation part of the conference call was to break it down into three questions. First, the facts, then the process that the House is using and the Senate may use. And then the third and last question will be whether this meets the constitutional legal standard for impeachment. So just my take on the facts is I think we're done now with the fact finding, and it looks like the House Judiciary Committee is going to just take as accepted the 300-page report from House Intelligence Committee Chairman Schiff. Might add some facts from the Mueller report, but doesn't seem to be that it's going to do any more investigation of its own. So I think the universe of facts are closed. I don't think that what we've seen has really moved the ball that much more forward than where we were before the House Intelligence Committee actually had its hearings. A lot of what we're still working with are the basic facts that are in the transcript of the phone call on July 25th between President Trump and the president of Ukraine, Zelensky. And in that call, we still see exactly what this is all about. President Trump talking to the president of Ukraine after that president had won a political victory and asking him to do him a favor. And the favor, the first part of the favor is a weird thing about CrowdStrike and Ukraine and being involved in the 2016 elections. But then after a little while, it turns to what's still the important question. Did President Trump pressure Ukraine to get a personal benefit by asking Ukraine to open an investigation into the Bidens? And recall that Hunter Biden had been placed on the board of the Burisma Natural Gas Company, for which he was completely unqualified and for which he received a lot of money. And then, of course, Vice President Biden had, while serving as vice president, pressured Ukraine into firing a prosecutor who might have been investigating that natural gas company. Asked him to do that favor, whether that was an effort by President Trump to get at corruption in Ukraine or whether it was something that was of great personal benefit only to the president in his reelection campaign to dig up dirt against his most likely opponent. I think most of the testimony that we heard since then has really been to nail down another part of the story, which is did President Trump, which he didn't mention in the phone call, but did President Trump around that time and then a little later on delay $400 million in foreign and military aid to Ukraine until the investigation was announced by Ukraine. And I think we saw 2 weeks of testimony by various civil servants, a few political appointees, ambassadors, and so on, all trying to really get at this question about whether it was a quid pro quo. Was it extortious? Did President Trump really hold this foreign aid in abeyance as a way to pressure Ukraine into doing something that was a personal benefit for him? I don't really think the facts have substantially changed that much after all of these hearings. My basic view is I'm willing to concede or accept that something like that happened, that President Trump did make this request. He didn't ask in the phone call for any kind of quid pro quo. He never threatens to withhold aid. But I think what the hearings show, and I don't think it's difficult to see this, that there were a variety of efforts to communicate to the Ukrainians in various ways through Rudy Giuliani or through Ambassador Sondland and so on, through various figures in the Ukrainian government of various levels of seniority, that this military aid and foreign aid was being held up. Now, in the end, the military aid was released. Actually, Ukraine is now receiving far more effective aid than it received under the Obama administration, right? It's now receiving lethal aid, whereas the Obama administration refused to provide lethal aid. And no investigation was ever started by Ukraine. And so I would say that's what we know now. In the end, I don't think that's going to change anybody's mind. And I think the polls reflect that. We don't really see any movement. The country seems about evenly divided between impeachment or not. John, what do you think?
Well, I agree with pretty much everything you just said, John. The biggest thing I absolutely agree with is I don't think that any of this, not only yesterday's hearing, but all of the proceedings, the 2 weeks of hearings before the House Intelligence Committee, I don't think that it has changed anybody's opinion one way or the other. If you believe that President Trump tried to involve Ukraine in the 2020 election and withheld aid for a quote-unquote personal benefit to dig up dirt on Joe Biden and used a ruse to get it, then you still believe that, and your views have been strengthened. If, on the other hand, you believe that the president, that unlike the career officials, all of whom testified, he gets to set foreign policy, that he had a more jaundiced view of the Ukrainians' commitment to anti-corruption efforts and whether he had a more jaundiced view about their attempts to defeat him in the 2016 election, and that, you know, he was entitled to express that skepticism and to, you know, look for them to demonstrate a willingness to come clean and turn over a new leaf, and, you know, that eventually the aid was released and there was no quid pro quo, nor did he ask for a quid pro quo. If that's what you believe, then your beliefs have been strengthened. I think that there are very, very few people who don't have an opinion on this issue, and those people that don't have an opinion on this issue are busy watching Maury and Jerry Springer and not paying attention to any of this at all. With respect to the facts, I agree with just about everything that you said. They are now bringing back Michael Gerhardt, University of North Carolina professor, brought back the Mueller report, specifically part two of the Mueller report, which was dealt with alleged obstruction of justice. And there will be articles of impeachment related to that. For all I know, they may draft something on volume one of the Mueller report and allege active collusion between Donald Trump and the Trump campaign and the Russians. I mean, I think that as you also pointed out, their theory of perfidy warranting impeachment and removal has been shifting over time. It was collusion and obstruction, and then it became quid pro quo and bribery, and then it was moved into abuse of power, and it's moved around. It's shifted. And that's okay. They're allowed to fish around and ask questions about all of this, but it makes it a little bit difficult to know what they're going to ultimately settle on. With respect to the facts, you know, I think it is very, very clear that the career diplomats in the State Department, you know, all believe President Zelensky and his anti-corruption attitudes, and they thought that this was insane to delay withholding these funds. I'm not going to denigrate any of them, but that's all well and good. But of course, their purpose is not to set foreign policy; it is to advise the president, who gets to set foreign policy. The president is entitled to believe what it is that he wants to believe. believe if there is any kind of a good faith basis to support those beliefs, and in this case, I think there was. So the three things that he talked about on the call and at other times is that, one, the United States provides too much foreign aid to other countries, and that there are other countries in Europe who ought to contribute more to helping the Ukrainians in their fight against the Russians on the Crimea. And, you know, he said that on the call. He has said that with respect to foreign aid for all kinds of countries. It's been a common theme of his since he was elected. The other two things that he talked about were Ukrainian interference into the 2016 election. And there is some evidence to support that too. So he talked about CrowdStrike, and he has this theory that it was the Ukrainians that hacked into the DNC server and not the Russians. I think there is very, very scant evidence, really no evidence, to support that, other than the fact that I would note that the DNC servers were never seized by the FBI, they were never examined by the FBI, and no one seems to know where those servers are, which is, of course, a very, very curious thing. But even if you totally set aside the hacking incident, there is plenty of evidence to suggest that the Ukrainians were, in a less pervasive and effective way than the Russians, trying to interfere in the 2016 election. And unlike the Russians, they were trying to help Hillary Clinton. And as evidence for that, I would point out, one, that in 2018, a Ukrainian court said that a Ukrainian politician and also the head of Ukraine's anti-corruption unit, that they illegally leaked the black ledgers. The black ledgers were the off-book payments between a pro-Russian Ukrainian party to Paul Manafort. They illegally leaked those ledgers in order to help Hillary Clinton. There's other evidence. The United States, the Ukrainian ambassador to the United States, wrote an article during the campaign in The Hill magazine severely criticizing Donald Trump. The Minister of Internal Affairs sent out a tweet during the campaign saying that Trump was a clown and a dangerous misfit and an even bigger danger to the United States than terrorism. The former prime minister of the Ukraine sent out a statement saying that Donald Trump challenged the very values of the free world. There was a Ukrainian-American who was hired by the DNC named Alexandra Chalupa, who was running around Ukraine gathering up dirt on Donald Trump and Paul Manafort. None of this was particularly a secret. Right after President Trump was elected, before he was inaugurated, Politico magazine published an article entitled "Ukrainian Efforts to Sabotage Trump Backfire. Kiev Officials Are Scrambling to Make Amends with President-elect After Quietly Working to Boost Clinton." So he had reasons to be skeptical about the Ukrainians' purity when it came to the 2016 election. And with respect to Burisma and the Bidens, there is evidence there too to suggest that, you know, that Joe Biden engaged in a corrupt endeavor with the Ukrainian government in order to benefit his son Hunter. Now, he contests all of that, but there is evidence to suggest that this may be so. Here's what it is in a nutshell. So in April of 2014, British authorities froze bank accounts totaling $23 million of the founder and owner of Burisma, a guy named Mykola Zlochevsky. The very next month, about 3 weeks later, Hunter Biden, whom, as you said, has no experience in the energy field, is appointed to the Burisma board. It's not just Hunter Biden, by the way. A business partner of his named Devin Archer is also appointed to the Burisma board. Those two have a third business partner who just happens to be the stepson of then Secretary of State John Kerry. So right after Zlochevsky's accounts are raided, Biden and Devin Archer, with no experience in the energy field, are appointed to the board. They are paid millions of dollars. In December 2015, the New York Times publishes an article saying Viktor Shokin, their general prosecutor general, the equivalent of their attorney general, is investigating Burisma. On February 2nd, Zlochevsky's home is raided and all of his assets and evidence is seized. In the immediate aftermath of that raid, there was a series of calls between Joe Biden and Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko. Burisma's lobbyist in America seeks a high-level meeting at the State Department and invokes Hunter Biden's name to get that meeting. Devin Archer has a face-to-face meeting with John Kerry. And right after that, Assistant Secretary Victoria Nuland comes out with a statement demanding that Victor Shokin, the lead prosecutor, be fired. A week later, Biden has his call with President Poroshenko and says that he will not release $1 billion in previously approved loan guarantees unless Shokin is fired. And guess what? Shokin is fired, and the funds are released. And Shokin has issued a statement saying, I was fired because the Bidens wanted to shut down that investigation on Burisma. Now, all of that may end up, at the end of the day, being bunk, just as all of these career prosecutors said. But it is certainly very colorable and would lead a reasonable person to say, this is worth looking into. At the end of the day, as you say, the funds were released, not only the $391 million in aid, but an additional $39 million sale of Javelin anti-tank missiles. Adam Schiff is running around saying, but of course the only reason that that aid was released was because of the whistleblower complaint. There are other reasons to believe that the aid was released too. Vice President Pence had just met with President Zelensky and came back and told Trump how impressed he was with him. There was a bipartisan group of senators, Ron Johnson of Wisconsin and Chris Murphy of Connecticut, who also had just met with Zelensky in Ukraine and came back and said how Congress totally supported President Zelensky and what they were trying to do. The funds were released. In other words, the facts are as clear as mud, and the Democrats are prepared to just assume the worst, and that's why we are where we are.
This is why John worked in the criminal division and I worked in OLC. He loves the facts. He loves the facts. I hate facts. Maybe we turn to the second issue, and in the Q&A we'll talk more about the facts. I do agree with John. I mean, I accept that the quid pro quo happened, but I think it's very difficult to tell. And I agree with your bottom line views that if it's very hard to tell. A lot of it has to do, to me, with the state of mind that
right.
President Trump had when he said those things in the phone call. And you can definitely read it two ways. And it seems, I agree with John, it really seems difficult to have impeachment go forward. Actually, let me say removal of the president go forward. Of course, impeachment is just when the House votes to send it to the Senate for trial. Whether the removal's justified on facts like these, but that we'll get to at the end. So second point, maybe just quickly, is the process. So this is where I have quite a lot of disagreement with the way the impeachment has gone forward so far in the House. I think one, the thing that bothers me the most, and I think that Jonathan Turley mentioned this in his testimony yesterday to the House Judiciary Committee. Jonathan was the Republican witness, and then you had three Democrat witnesses, Pam Carlin, Mike Gerhardt, and Noah Feldman. The speed of the investigation bothers me. If you look at when the complaint about the whistleblower first started to get kicked around in the media, you're talking, I think, around the end of August, early September. And within impeachment proceedings start in the middle of September. And basically, the investigation is over by the end of October, early November. You're talking about 2 months. That troubles me. I think it's quite different than earlier impeachments, particularly the Clinton impeachment, because in the Clinton impeachment, Ken Starr's independent counsel investigation had done all the fact-finding. Here, there's been no prosecutors, no one else. Congress hasn't delegated, as it has in the past, the job to do the fact-finding. 2 months just seems like not close to enough time. And you can also see that in the big holes. We have a lot of things that John's bothered with. John Malcolm, my friend, is bothered with the facts and things that trouble me could be cleared up, I think, quite easily if an investigation was done thoroughly. And by thoroughly, I mean calling actually the witnesses that matter the most. That would be the chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, Vice President Pence, National Security Advisor John Bolton, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. I don't see how you can really be confident that you've found out the facts on whether an impeachable offense occurred without hearing from them. Now, of course, several of them are fighting or refusing to obey subpoenas. This has happened before. You know, any of us who've worked in government have seen this happen before in oversight hearings. It always gets worked out in the end. And here what bothers me is that the House didn't really even try and didn't even wait to work out an agreement to allow these most important people to testify. It seems to me if you're going to go forward with the gravest constitutional responsibility that the House has under the Constitution, you have a duty and an obligation to try to hear from all of those people so that you're confident you've really canvassed all the events and witnesses to get the facts down. And so I fear that the House, by rushing the process, has actually doomed their effort in the Senate, because I fully expect the Senate, given the weird rules that it has, the Senate doesn't really have a trial. In the past, the Senate has basically just heard oral argument. They don't see witnesses in person. They don't see evidence. They don't touch anything. They don't question anybody. Really, the trial, to me, takes place in the House in terms of getting all the facts out. And the House, I think, by doing it in this truncated fashion, has doomed its case in the Senate. And so it goes back to what John and I started with before. Nothing here changed anything. You might get maybe two or three senators from the Republican Party might switch to convict. But I think on this facts, with this kind of evidence, while not even getting to the constitutional standards at issue here, which are important, the House has doomed itself to lose. John?
Yeah, I agree with everything you just said. I don't think that even if these other witnesses did come forward, that would likely change anything. I mean, if you look at the president's approval ratings, they really haven't budged. He has a core level of support that is really, really firm, and anybody who would vote to convict him might have a hard time. There are 45 Democrats in the Senate, two independents, Angus King and Bernie Sanders. So you assume that they vote with them. That gets you to 47 senators. You would need at least, assuming they all stick together, Manchin, Doug Jones, or whatever, don't cross over, you need at least 20 Republican senators to cross over to remove him and hit that magic number of 67. And I just don't, I didn't see it. And I don't see it. But look, I agree with you. You know, there are a lot of fact witnesses, if you really wanted to do a thorough job, who have not appeared yet. And I think that eventually the Democrats might get, if they were more patient, get that testimony. I mean, there's already been a lower court, district court order saying that, you know, the former White House counsel, Don McGahn, has to testify. The arguments are very much the same, I think, with respect to Bolton and Mulvaney and Pompeo. So I think that the Democrats stuck with this and let the process play out, they would probably win in court. But they have the difficult problem of they are running into 2020, and at the moment at least, so far as I can tell, nobody is paying any attention to any of the people on the Democratic side who are running for the nomination. And so the clock is their enemy, because they've got the Iowa caucuses, what, they're in January or the first week in February, and then there's the New Hampshire primary, and then there's Super Tuesday, and they're all off to the races. And you've got all of these people out there trying to get some attention, and nobody's paying any attention to them because they're all busy paying attention to impeachment. So I understand the plight that the Democrats are facing, but if they wanted to do a thorough job and actually persuade anybody who was persuadable, who didn't already have an opinion one way or the other, I certainly think, as Jonathan Turley said yesterday and as John, you just said today, they are short-circuiting the process. But, you know, have no fear. A lot of these Democrats are unhinged. And if you think that this impeachment process isn't going to end so well, perhaps you might be interested in what Neil Katyal, the former acting Solicitor General, tweeted out today, in which he tweeted the following. Important note on future. If the Senate doesn't vote to convict Trump or tries to monkey with this trial, he could, of course, be retried in the new Senate should he win re-election. Double jeopardy protections do not apply, and senators voting on impeachment in the next few months know this. So perhaps if they rush the process this time around, they'll get it right the next time around. Back to you, John.
I didn't know Neil had said that. That would just be so much fun. I think Neil's just out to create a Law Commentator's Full Employment Act. Just, you know, the Trump presidency is a great gift for those of us who like to observe and discuss constitutional law and politics. So let's turn to the very last issue before we open up to the floor, which is what yesterday's hearings were about. And I think the looming question over all this is this taking even the Democrats' claims about the facts to be true, is this impeachable conduct and should the Senate remove? And this is one of the murkiest phrases in the Constitution. What is the meaning of, now we know what treason and bribery is, but what are other high crimes and misdemeanors, which is the standard for impeachment. And as John said, the Senate, under the Constitution, has to convict by two-thirds. And the framers, if you look at the history, intentionally put that standard in there of both other high crimes and misdemeanors and two-thirds, because they wanted to prevent impeachment from being used, as unfortunately what appears to be used now, a partisan tool by a party in Congress that dislikes and wants to remove a president. Now, they were very worried about the idea of our system devolving into some kind of parliamentary system where the president really just became a prime minister for the majority party in Congress. They wanted the president to be independent and vigorous and not subject to recall or control by Congress through this threat of impeachment. And so they wanted to make sure that if we really were going to remove a president in a method other than elections, that it represent a very high consensus amongst the population. And it appears, I think as John rightly showed, that that doesn't have that kind of support right now. But I actually think, and maybe this is where John and I are finally going to disagree, I actually think that this is impeachable conduct, this kind of activity, this kind of charge against President Trump. But I don't think the facts are serious enough to meet the level you would want for removal. So I think if you look at the evidence, and actually I'm quite surprised that the people the Democrats asked to testify, I think Mike Gerhardt has written a book about impeachment. I mean, he has written the book on impeachment. Pam Carlin and Noah Feldman, although they're important constitutional law scholars, they're not scholars of impeachment. And I think they're, the written testimony was kind of disappointing in that regard. In the quotes and sound bites you got from the hearing itself, didn't really, I think, lay out the best case for the Democrats, actually. I'm really quite persuaded by the historical evidence. If you look at the historical evidence, there is several examples where the framers said, other high crimes and misdemeanors have to include not just things that are crimes, but serious abuses of power. And they say, and they actually quite clearly say, impeachment does not mean all crimes. So all crimes are not impeachable offenses. But there are also things that aren't crimes that could be impeachable offenses. And they gave interesting examples that involve the foreign affairs power. One was the King of France, Louis XIV, basically paying the King of England, Charles II, amount of money every year. And in exchange, the King of England decided not to get involved in any of the continental wars that Louis XIV was engaged in. And then a second one that I sort of discussed, I'm finishing this book on Trump and the Constitution. I found this nugget, I guess I should write it up at some point, is they talked about treaties that a president could sign or engage in that would advance his interest, his state's interest, even his political party's interest, but sacrifice the national interest. Not even a crime, but again, the framers said this is also an example of something that could be a high crime misdemeanor. So my point is just that the founders believed that a president could abuse his foreign affairs power in a way to benefit himself or his political party or even his own state, such that it would be an impeachable offense, even though it wasn't treason or bribery. Now, the problem is, to me, and this is where I think what John's saying, what I'm saying about the facts and the process make a difference, is I don't see that the facts here are serious enough. They don't rise to the level of France, bribing the King of England. They don't rise yet to the level of a president signing a treaty that sacrifices the national interest. Consequences do matter, not just the intent. But I think the actual effects in the real world of what the president was trying to do matter in this scale, because a serious abuse of power has to actually be serious. I don't think the framers thought you would impeach someone for every abuse of something. Otherwise, we could have impeached a great many other presidents. I think it was Congressman Ken Buck, I think, went through very effectively all these things that, say, John F. Kennedy, FDR, and LBJ had done, like wiretap their political opponents and use the IRS to audit their enemies. That would have been maybe even worse than what Trump has done, but no one thought about impeaching them for. The second thing I say is, then I expect if these things don't rise to the level, the facts here don't rise to the level of impeachment offense, what's the remedy? And I think that's where we really get down to what the framers really thought would be the control on any kind of presidential piece of power, which would be elections. And it seems to me just sort of unfathomable as a matter of constitutional structure that you would try to impeach and remove a president for these kinds of facts in the same year as an election year. If the House, I think, had been smarter about it, President Trump's Christmas, they would have conducted oversight. Actually, it's a weird thing. I think Nancy Pelosi was originally right. Just having oversight hearings, put all this evidence out for the American people to see, and as the framers intended it, let the American people render the verdict on President Trump in November. I think that's the most effective remedy for presidential abuses of power. John?
So, I mean, I hate to disappoint you, John, but I actually agree with you about the standards of impeachment. The only person I hear running around and saying that it has to be a criminal offense is Alan Dershowitz. But Jonathan Turley, I think, pointed out correctly that the only two really serious – I mean, the first impeachment effort against Andrew Johnson was very serious. He barely survived, but he was saved by Republicans who detested the man because at the end of the day they thought that this was political and certainly not criminal or even a gross abuse of power. But in the cases of Nixon and Clinton, we were talking about clearly criminal conduct. You know, Alexander Hamilton in Federalist 65 wrote that the subject of its jurisdiction, its being impeachment trials, are those offenses which proceed from the misconduct of public men, or in other words, from the abuse of violation of some public trust. They are of a nature which may be the peculiar propriety to be denominated political, as they relate chiefly to injuries done immediately to the society itself. So I agree with you if you accepted the Democrats' speculation as fact that not providing this aid was clearly against the best interests of the United States, and that the sole reason why Donald Trump was insisting in a quid pro quo, you will get this aid, but only if you dig up dirt on my rival, and that's what was motivating him, that could rise to the level of being an impeachable offense. I didn't really hear anybody yesterday disagreeing about what the standards are for impeachment. There was a radical disagreement, it continues to be, about the factual basis for the formulation of these impeachable offenses, and I don't see that going away. And I guess before we turn it over to questions, the one thing I would say is that you know, he will be impeached. It will be almost exclusively, if not exclusively, on party lines, and maybe, as John said, two or three senators, so maybe Collins, Murkowski, maybe Romney, cross over and vote to remove, but you know, that'll be it. And in 1998, when we were talking about the Clinton impeachment, the very same Jerry Nadler yesterday, who was suggesting that the president should be drawn and quartered, said that there must never be a narrowly voted impeachment when impeachment is supported by one of our major political parties and opposed by the other. Such an impeachment will produce divisiveness and bitterness in our politics for years to come and will call into question the very legitimacy of our political institutions. And I think that's what Professor Turley was saying yesterday, and I think he's right.
Here is our first caller of the day.
Hi, it's Michael Rossman calling. I have a question for John Malcolm, and I apologize. I came a couple of minutes late, but I don't think anyone discussed this. The Democrats have been speaking about bribery as a potential impeachment article, and I'd just like, if you could, to explain what the theory is and your opinion about it, because it would seem to me that our foreign policy is almost constantly giving money or providing money or offering money to foreign countries in exchange for them doing things. I don't fully understand the theory behind how it could be a criminal case of bribery. I'd like you, if you could, to explain it and give us your opinion about it.
Sure, Michael. Well, thanks for calling in. I mean, the theory is simple, which is to say, gee, we'd really like you to use the president's phrase, President Zelensky, I want you to do me a favor. I want you to dig up dirt on the Bidens, and here's what I'm going to give you to do it, specifically $391 million in military aid. And we'll, you know, with the promise that we'll help you in other ways too. You could flip that around, as the Democrats have also tried to do, and say it's extortion, saying, well, this was previously approved funds, so you ought to get it, but we're not going to give it to you unless you give us this dirt. So that's the way you would spin that. You are, of course, very correct that presidents have used foreign aid as leverage in lots of ways. I mean, Barack Obama threatened to withhold hundreds of millions of dollars in aid to Egypt, and in a conversation with President al-Sisi said, you know, we're not going to give you this aid until you do more to cooperate with our counterterrorism efforts, and you got to also tamp down on your crackdown on the Muslim Brotherhood. Obama also threatened to do the same with African nations unless they adopted more gay-friendly policies. You know, and the biggest example of an explicit quid pro quo would be Joe Biden saying, well, yeah, we have $1 billion in previously approved loan guarantees, but you're not getting it until you fire your attorney general. And he got what he wanted. That's why they're saying what they're saying, but you're pointing out that we have used foreign aid as leverage to try to get other governments to do things that we think are in the best interest of the United States, which, by the way, sometimes politically benefits, you know, the president who happens to be in office. That's as old as our country.
Great question. I think there's two additional points I'd like to – I mean, we go farther than John Malcolm here. You know, one is we bribe people all the time. What do you think the CIA does? The CIA bribes people who are with cash, who are foreign government officials, to get them to do stuff that we want them to do. I don't think anyone would think we would apply the bribery statute to government agents who are bribing people. What we worry about is the president and our officials being bribed to do things for other countries. I don't think there's anything wrong with us bribing everybody else. And just to make it clear, this is something, of course, the founders would have known about. At the time of the Constitution, we were paying millions of dollars in tribute to the Barbary Pirates. Remember these guys, the Barbary Pirates, so that the American ships wouldn't be attacked and American sailors wouldn't be taken hostage in the Mediterranean. This went on through from the Continental Congress through to Thomas Jefferson's presidency. So I can't imagine that the founders would have thought, oh, the some kind of exchange for money and you know, with some foreign benefit is actually an outright per se violation of the bribery clause in impeachment. But the second thing is, and this is, I think, another mistake the House Democrats are making, is they keep referring to the federal bribery statute. The federal bribery statute is far more detailed than bribery in the Constitution. The federal bribery statute's passed, I think, in the 20th century. There's no federal bribery statute on the books. You know, of course, at the time of the Constitution or for 100 years after the Constitution.
Right.
So this effort to try to make it this very fine-tuned, like honest services claim if you do something and you're withholding a benefit, you're getting benefit under the bribery statute, that doesn't matter. What matters is it bribery within the Constitution? And actually, this is a Marbury versus Madison kind of question. Congress can't change the meaning of the bribery offense in the impeachment clause merely by passing a statute which it thinks is bribery. That's basically Marbury says. Congress can't use statutes to change or expand the meaning of words in the Constitution. So I think Democrats are actually quite off on using bribery. In the end, they have to go back to high crimes and misdemeanors.
Yeah, I agree with that. The only thing I would add is if you want to think of an example of foreign funds being used as bribery, just think about pallets of billions of dollars of unmarked bills being delivered to Iran for the Iran nuclear deal.
Caller, you are up.
Hi, this is Warren Belmar calling. Two points. One, I'm afraid that what's happened here is that we've turned impeachment into a partisan political weapon, especially if people are saying that if we control the House and the president gets reelected, we'll consider impeachment all over again. But more importantly, you've noted that the Constitutional Convention originally had the word maladministration as the part of the standard, and that was dropped in favor of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. What no one seems to focus on is what the Founding Fathers thought was adequate for removal of a member of Congress. And for a House or Senate decision, the standard in the Constitution in Article 1 is disorderly behavior. And I think what we're seeing here is the House Democratic leadership converting the standard for the president into the standard for itself, a standard which is very rarely ever applied in either the House or the Senate.
You are right that originally what was proposed by George Mason was to include, it said treason, bribery, and maladministration, and at the urging of James Madison and others, maladministration was removed from precisely the reasons you might think, which is it thought it was too loose a standard and that the president would then be under the thumb always of the Senate, and they replaced it with other high crimes and misdemeanors. Yeah, look, the Senate, you're right. It's interesting to note that the first person in this country who was actually impeached was a United States senator. He never went to trial because the Senate decided that rather than have an impeachment trial, that he wasn't an appointed official, probably didn't fit within the definition of people who are subject to impeachment, but that either way, they would choose to use the Senate's own rules to expel him, which they did. So yeah, they have their own standards, and perhaps they are being somewhat hypocritical.
I think, Warren, you actually have a better example at hand even than the standard for removing a senator, which is impeachment of judges. Right? Impeachment of judges requires that they not have acted in good behavior.
Right.
And so you could actually, I don't think people have argued this in the hearings, but it seems clear to me that the standard for impeaching judges is actually lower than the standard for impeaching a president. However, if you look at the books and reports that are done on impeachment, because there have only been two presidential impeachments, Johnson and Clinton, there's no precedent or case law to go on. So people who are in favor of impeaching President Trump, they try to draw a lot of analogies to what the Senate and the House have done with judicial impeachments. And so they, for example, you might see one argument out there that President Trump could be impeached for things he did before he was even president, which I think is completely mistaken. But that's because there was a federal judge who was impeached before he became a federal judge for taking bribes as a state judge. Whatever that is, whether that's impeachable or not for a judge, the standard is just completely different. Good behavior is just a different standard than, I think, as you suggest, the higher standard that's there for presidents. Let me make another point about maladministration. And John Malcolm's quite right, and you were quite right, Warren, that the standard was deliberately changed for treason, bribery, and maladministration to treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. And there's a lot of debate in the scholarship about what did they understand that to mean. As John's right, maladministration clearly suggested removal over policy differences, and they didn't want that to happen. So we know the floor, but we don't know, right? I mean, we know what it's intended to exclude, but we don't know what's intended to include. And so I think the best thing here is let's be good textualists. Treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. Other high crimes and misdemeanors, right? You take the standard canon of construction, you would think has to be on a similar level of seriousness with treason and bribery. And so that's why I think other high crimes and misdemeanors can't just be any time the president does something wrong. Can't be any time the president does something unconstitutional. It has to be times where the act, no matter what it is serious enough to justify removal that would be on the same plane as treason and bribery. And one last point, I think you're completely right that this has become a partisan affair, and John's quite right when he said a lot of Democrats during the Clinton impeachment were saying things like you shouldn't have close votes, shouldn't be a partisan affair. You totally saw that in the way the hearings were run. I think another thing the House Democrats did very poorly was really excluding a role for House Republicans in the management of the impeachment inquiry in the first place, even to the point yesterday where rather than picking professors to testify who might have been more impartial or even testifying against the interests of their own political party, you saw a lineup of people who had several times already called for the president's impeachment even before the Ukraine issue came up, but were Democrats. And so it was just like a regular hearing in the House where each side brought up its own partisan witnesses rather than trying to reach for some broader consensus. And I think that's unfortunately infected the whole impeachment inquiry today. And I fully expect, as John said, that there'll be an impeachment vote that will be down the party line. And I expect you would see a similar vote at the Senate trial, too.
I'm going to disagree with you on that. I think that the members of the House and the members of the Senate are facing a profiles and courage moment where they're being called upon to make a principled decision that will affect our politics going forward for years to come. And if this is sanctioned by the House as a partisan weapon, today, it is going to be a partisan weapon for a long time, and that is not what the Founding Fathers intended impeachment to be.
Well, I agree with the second part of what it is you said, but not the first part of what you said. Somebody's here in Washington. I can tell you, even at the time when John Kennedy wrote Profiles in Courage, it was a thin book. And the other thing that I would point out, John raises a very interesting...
Theodore Sorensen wrote the book.
fair enough. It was ghostwritten, another Profile in Courage. John raises the interesting point about a different standard for judges because they serve in good behavior. I got to think about that. In fact, two judges who were impeached, John pointed to one. There was another who was impeached for lying on his FBI background form before he became a judge. So that was clearly conduct before he became sworn in as a judge. And another was also impeached and removed for public drunkenness. So there may be something to that. And I would say the only thing I would disagree slightly with John is that I think the Republicans were a little bit canny in picking Jonathan Turley, not only because he has testified before in impeachment proceedings and represented Judge Porteous during his impeachment proceeding, but he made it quite clear that he didn't vote for the president and doesn't like a lot of what the president does. So to some extent, it made it gave it a little more heft, I think, by saying, well, look, this guy clearly doesn't like the president. He didn't vote for him. He's not going to vote for him next time either. But even he is saying that he shouldn't be impeached and removed based on this evidence.
Very good. Thank you so much, Warren. Next caller, you are up.
Yes, my name is Tim Harker. I'm in Potomac, Maryland. In trying to figure out what impeachment is by defining what it couldn't be, I'm curious as to your thoughts about an effort to criminalize or politicize, rather to criminalize politics. The Supreme Court in the McConnell case, which was the Governor McConnell case, had some interesting thoughts about McDonald. Yeah, about the corruption and politics and the relationship between the two. The court drew a pretty sharp line there, and I'm curious about whether what the Democrats are up to doesn't really criminalize politics in the sense of just basic log rolling. How is this different from log rolling, which congressmen do every day?
I do take the point that there is a kind of, I wouldn't say criminalization, but the use of impeachment to fight out policy differences. And I think there's two actual fights going on here. One we talked about a lot, one we didn't talk about that much. So the one that we haven't talked about that much about is actually the fight between the elected president and the career civil service. So sometimes in the media you hear Republican Party members calling it the deep state. I wouldn't go that far. The deep state is more like a phrase that's used to discuss authoritarian governments and, you know, the military intelligence services. I don't think that things with our civil service are quite like that. But I think one thing you're really seeing here is a sort of a rebellion by these career civil servants in the State Department, National Security Council, who just did not like the president's approach to Ukraine. They also didn't like the way the president was conducting foreign policy by using private people like Rudy Giuliani to conduct diplomacy for the president. And they didn't like President Trump. They're all entitled to have those views. But, choosing not to use this, much praised thing called the interagency process and consensus doesn't bind the president. These people are supposed to work for the president. The president doesn't work for them. And you saw, I think, in the hearings this sort of fight, not just between political opponents, but between this career civil service that wants to control foreign policy and a president who's politically elected and doesn't feel bound by those conventions. And then so I think that's one kind of fight. And then the other fight I think you're referring to is, of course, more partisan fight between Republicans and Democrats. It's not really a policy fight about Ukraine in this sense. And it's just like when I think of the Democratic Party, I don't think of them having any particularly strong views on Ukraine. And actually, I think there's a lot of, one thing is showing is there's a lot of disagreement and debate in our country about the right approach to Ukraine. But I do think that this is just the pretext. I think Ukraine is more the pretext for the larger partisan fight between the Democratic Party, particularly the base of it, and these presidential candidates who are all demanding impeachment, which Nancy Pelosi initially wanted to resist because I think she was right. I think she saw this was going to be a political disaster for the Democratic Party. and president who they just refused to accept as legitimate and have refused to accept it for pretty much the entire time of his presidency.
So let me make three quick points. So, Tim, I think your point about that this could represent the weaponization of the impeachment process is correct. McDonald is slightly different. It's an important point in that the Supreme Court unanimously in McDonald tried to delineate what would clearly be corruption from what would be log rolling and everyday politics. And so that was important, but of course that was a criminal case where somebody's going to be a convicted felon and incarcerated, and that's the impeachment process is not criminal. But your point about the need for clarity, at least in terms of the facts, if not the standard you use, to discern between really abusive, if not outright criminal behavior and standard leverage and log rolling is a good one. With respect to the point about the deep state, I agree with what John said, but I find one thing at least curious. Not only were these career politicians dead set against the president and hated what he was doing with Ukraine, but people are all talking about the whistleblower, who the whistleblower is, should the whistleblower testify. And I am less insistent that the whistleblower testify. I will just accept as a given that the whistleblower is a partisan and that the whistleblower had no firsthand knowledge. But what I consider significant is that all of these career people ran to somebody who is clearly a partisan, who was one of their peers, and he went and hired an attorney who literally 10 days after Trump was sworn into office said a coup had begun and it was time for the lawyers to go in to effectuate this coup. And then the last point I would make about with respect to drawing other countries into our politics. You know, the Democrats are again speaking a little bit out of both sides of their mouths, in that in May of 2018, three Democratic senators, Menendez, Durbin, and Leahy, wrote a letter to the prosecutor general in Ukraine saying, you know, gee, we may not give you aid in the future and you may ruin your bipartisan reputation unless you continue cooperating with the Mueller probe. Democrats have had no trouble on occasion holding out aid as both a carrot and a stick in order to involve those countries in what some might perceive as being partisan politics as well.
Let's go to our next question.
You guys both mentioned the phrase, I think Nancy Pelosi was right. I'm just curious if that's a phrase that commonly rolls off your tongues. My actual question was I confess to a bit of confusion about why it seems the quid pro quo aspect is so significant, because to my mind, foreign affairs is, you know, generally conducted with a wink and a nod. And so, you know, there's always a quid pro quo. It seems like the real question underlying is, was it a legitimate request? You know, sure the investigation of Biden's son would have helped Trump, but is there a legitimate basis for it as well as a personal basis? So I don't know if you guys can expound on sort of the quid pro quo. That would be useful for me.
I agree with everything you just said. The only complicating factor is that we have an impoundment act that says that sort of once Congress approves it, it takes away some of the leverage that the president actually has, because if you pass the end of the fiscal year and those funds haven't been dispersed, arguably the president has violated the law. That didn't happen here. But, you know, look, if Joe Biden can say you're not going to get $1 billion in previously approved loan guarantees unless you fire this prosecutor, and his stated reason, or what he said, saying now, the reason is because this guy is corrupt and he's not serious about investigating corruption in his country. If there was a legitimate basis for that, then I don't see anything wrong with Biden doing that. And if there is a legitimate basis to undertake an inquiry about Ukrainian interference in the 2016 election, and a legitimate basis to at least undertake an investigation about corruption in that country involving Burisma and possibly the Bidens, and I think the factual predicate was there to at least initiate those investigations, I think it's perfectly okay.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, the House Democrats have dropped quid pro quo because they realized it didn't really make much sense and wasn't carrying any weight with the public. It doesn't, as you say, the quid pro quo is sort of so general as to be useless, because, as you say, foreign policy, if we're doing it right, everything we're doing in foreign policy should redound to some kind of benefit to the United States. I mean, if we're doing something purely altruistic, we're not actually acting necessarily in our national interest then. So you could characterize this in most things we do in foreign policy as involving some kind of exchange of benefits. So that itself can't be impeachable. The only thing that could be impeachable is if you could show that what the president was doing was not actually for any national benefit, but was purely only for his own personal benefit. And this I think John and I both pointed out this problem is that a lot of things that presidents do that benefit themselves also benefit the country. Presidents are going to be egomaniacs. They're going to often think that things that benefit themselves are good for the country too. And you could talk with lots of examples can be raised, people raise these examples, but FDR and LBJ and Kennedy, all doing things which they thought were in their interest, but also in the national interest. And so the thing that is really difficult about this quid pro quo thing, I think the reason the Democrats dropped it is because they have to show that when Trump was asking for this favor, this wasn't just some kind of rambling way for Trump to ask about corruption, because this Biden thing was just stuck in his mind as the leading example. And you can see when he talks in public, but also on this phone call, a lot of the things he says are sort of rambling and imprecise. And I think that's the difficulty with the Democrats to show, no, this is really only about helping Trump himself and not helping the country. And so, in this way, I want to sort of modify something John Malcolm might have said, which is, yes, Congress appropriates funds and the president has to distribute them. But there's also this sort of, I believe, this practical understanding that we will delay money to and foreign aid to corrupt governments. So if Congress, say, allocated money to go, some third world country where there is this utterly corrupt dictator, and suppose we knew that that dictator would just take that money and put it right into his pocket, just not even use it for that country's benefit at all, just like turned around and put it in his Swiss bank account. I'm sure this has happened before. But I don't think anyone would complain if the president said, no, I'm going to delay and hold the transfer of that money until, we're persuaded it actually gets to the country and the dictator's just not putting it in his pocket. And I think that's the best defense. I think what Trump did here was this was kind of his sort of shorthand, sort of imprecise, rambling way of talking about what I'm really getting at is corruption, not the Bidens, and for my reelection.
Here is our next question.
Good morning. I'll try to speak fast. I'm just kind of wondering if you have views as to the relevance of the Supreme Court in the impeachment process. And the hypothetical would be if the House impeached and they used that bribery statute that John referred to, the federal bribery statute, involving the issue of Marbury versus Madison, and then the Senate convicted, understanding that the Chief Justice would have presided over that. Do you think the Supreme Court would have any place in the proceedings at that point?
No. So the Supreme Court considered a case in 1973. It was U.S. versus Nixon, but it was a federal judge named Walter Nixon. And he had actually, the trial took place before one of the committees of the Senate, who then wrote a report and submitted it to the full Senate, and they voted to remove him. And he said no, that was an improper process. And in a unanimous opinion written by Chief Justice Rehnquist, they said that the House has the sole power to impeach, and the Senate has the sole power to try impeachments. And even the Chief Justice, who will be presiding over the trial, any ruling that he makes, the Senate by a majority vote can overrule. So I think the answer to that is no. John, do you have a different view?
No, and in fact, if you look at that opinion, it was 93, by the way, not 73. But John's right in that whenever Nixon appeared in the Supreme Court, he lost, whatever his name is, whichever Nixon it is. It's interesting. So, one example they give is exactly this example, because they said there were two things they were worried about. One was it would be weird for the judiciary, a member of the judiciary, to be impeached and then the judiciary being able to review that. So we wouldn't want that. Would be kind of like a self-dealing. But it was interesting that I think they mentioned it would be really difficult to allow judicial review when there's a president being impeached, because since the Chief Justice is a trial judge and the Chief Justice is the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, you'd be asking to review the impeachment. you would have a case where the Supreme Court would be reviewing the Chief Justice's own decisions on appellate review, which, so the court said that's so improper and illogical that that's another reason why we won't allow judicial review of an impeachment. So essentially, they sort of, this Nixon case did sort of foresee this possibility. Now, at the time they decided it, you know, it was Chief Justice Rehnquist wrote the Nixon case. The Clinton impeachment hadn't happened. No one thought there would be a presidential impeachment again in our lifetimes. Now we've had, you know, we're going to have had two. And so one last thing is a lot of outstanding questions about what the Chief Justice can and can't do during the Senate trial. And the past rules have essentially treated the senators like jurors. And so what's going to happen, say, if Ted Cruz gets up and says, I want to move to change all the Senate rules for impeachment so we could have a real trial and have the witnesses show up in the well of the Senate and let's ask them questions and cross-examine them. So that would be really interesting to see what Chief Justice Roberts is going to say. I expect a Republican senator will make such a motion. Otherwise, I can't imagine Ted Cruz and Mike Lee sitting there silently at their desks, not speaking for weeks.
They did have at the Clinton trial snippets of a videotaped deposition.
Just played, yeah, played to them.
So they can have live witnesses. They just haven't. We'll see. Maybe Hunter Biden and Adam Schiff will be in the well of the Senate testifying. We'll see.
Well, my great hope is that Trump will show up and represent himself and give his own closing arguments and speak at great length, and none of the senators will be able to answer back under the rules.
That would be quite the ratings bonanza.
That would be astounding. Well, caller, thank you so much for your question. John Malcolm, again, looking at the time, I do want to see if you have any closing remarks before we wrap up today. John Malcolm, do you have anything to say?
No, I'm sure something's going to happen in the near future, and John and I will be back. So whatever it is I would say, I'll save for then.
Yeah, see you on the day of the House vote. We'll pick a date now, and I'm sure it'll fall on that date just by chance.
Well, John Malcolm, on behalf of the Federal Society, thank you again so much for the benefit of your time and expertise today. We welcome all listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for calling in and asking all these great questions. We are now adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.